Hello, I'm Christine Bywater. You are listening to part three of a three-part conversation in the series Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was. On this episode, Learning Leads, Technology Serves, Promoting Student Agency, Authority, and Identity, we speak with three guests about the state of educational technology after COVID-19. With an emergency investment in infrastructure to make possible remote learning, schools now have the devices in the broadband, but is it equitable? What types of learning should be happening on these devices? And how do we promote more powerful learning experiences through the use of technology? What about all that data? What considerations should districts make when it comes to student privacy? Resources mentioned during the episode can be found under the Resources tab at our website, cset.stanford.edu. This series was created in collaboration with the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching and the Policy Analysis for California Education at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. This endeavor was made possible by Stanford's Transforming Learning Accelerator, initiative born out of Stanford's long-range vision and the Graduate School of Education. Hello, and welcome to our third and final conversation in our series, Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was. We are so glad you've taken time to join us for this conversation. I'm Christine Bywater, one of your hosts of this conversation from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching at Stanford's Graduate School of Education. I want to start by first acknowledging that I'm broadcasting from my home in Pacifica, which sits on the unceded territory of the Romatush Ohlone, who are the past, present, and future caretakers of this land. I acknowledge I am a guest here and recognize that I benefit from living and working on their ancestral homeland. I am acknowledging the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Romatush community and by affirming their sovereign rights as First People. Additionally, the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, CSET, is committed to engaging in meaningful conversations around timely topics, and this effort is indebted to the groundwork laid by Nicole Luciani-Elliott and Dr. Michael Hines, who developed the structure and format of which we are using for this series. Their podcast, Teaching to Meet the Moment, is available to stream on Podbean and on our CSET website.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Janet Carlson. I'm the faculty director of the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, where we are committed to changing what is happening in schools so we can disrupt inequities. However, before we can talk about the space of equity inclusion as it relates to educational technology, I must acknowledge that today I'm broadcasting from Colorado Springs, and the land on which I am currently working, teaching, and living is the traditional and unceded territory of the Ute peoples. The earliest documented peoples also include the Apache, Arapaho, Comanche, and Cheyenne. This acknowledgement demonstrates a commitment for the process of working to dismantle ongoing legacies of settler colonialism. Christine and I are honored to be hosting this conversation today because it's our assessment that the K-12 educational system is at a critical point in the conversation about the uses of educational technology and its relationship with teaching and learning. We invited our three guests today because of their specific expertise and vision that will open up a discussion with us about what paths we can pursue so that learning is in the foreground and the use of devices supports all educators and students as we reimagine and rebuild a better future for our kids. Christine, could you start the conversation by just reminding us about the last year?
Sure. So there's actually a report out by the Consortium for School Networking. And according to data collected by that report, before the outbreak of COVID-19, about half of school districts provided some off-campus broadband services to their students, most often through the use of mobile hotspots. This past year, that number has soared to 95% of school districts. So that may come as no surprise, given that nearly every district in the country had to make some opportunities for remote learning. But that jump does illustrate just how dramatic a change it was for schools. We also see similar jumps when we look at devices and platforms, as many districts made purchases of those things to try and achieve some level of equitable access for students and instructional ability for educators. But we also know, as some of our guests from last week shared, that teachers who were already stretched to their limits were faced with impossible work situations. They were being asked to design and deliver effective instruction and assess student learning, all within a new environment with new platforms, and all while managing their own personal lives as they navigated the complexities of the last year and a half. Everyone was just trying to survive. So now what? as we approach restarting school in the fall, we now have an infrastructure that didn't exist a year and a half ago that privileges the use of technology. Students have access to devices, networks, and platforms that the educational technology community has been advocating for years. But the existence of technology is not enough. It's how you use it. So how do we move from surviving to thriving and let the learning lead and the technology serve? What does it take to create and sustain technology-rich, powerful learning experiences while also safeguarding student and family privacy? Our three guests today will discuss just that. I'm going to introduce our guests. Our first guest is Sandra Velasquez. She's the Innovative Learning and Technology Integration Coordinator at the San Mateo County Office of Education. Her primary work focuses on high-leverage pedagogical strategies, utilizing technology to support strategic leadership and instructional equity. Sandra has over 20 years of experience in education, serving students and professionals at all levels, including K-12 education, court and community schools, and higher education. She holds a master's degree in educational leadership and technology, an educational administrative leadership credential from San Diego State University. She is a U.S. Department of State DAS Fulbright Scholar from Uzbekistan 2019 and Silicon Valley Computer Using Educator Q board member. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest is Aaron Ragsdale. He is the Makery Lab Manager at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. Before taking his position at Stanford, Aaron was a Makerspace Manager at East Palo Alto Academy. He is interested in investigating learning environments that facilitate novel student-centered pedagogies. Aaron is also working on building makerspaces that are inclusive, authentic, and sustainable, especially in under-resourced communities. Aaron's formal education is in engineering. He has a BSEE from Tuskegee University and MSEE from Stanford University. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me.
And our third guest is Duane J. McClary, who is the director of the Digital Promise League of Innovative Schools. Duane comes to Digital Promise most recently as the Director of Educational Technology and Library Programs at the DC Public Schools, where he supervised the district's one-to-one pilot and rollout, as well as other innovation initiatives. He has 15 years of broad and deep experience as a teacher and district leader, because in addition to his time in that urban setting of DC Public Schools, he's also worked in the rural South Carolina setting and the suburbs of Virginia. Welcome, Duane.
Great, thank you, nice to be here.
We've just shared small snippets from each of these guest biographies, but I don't think that bios typically capture the full picture of a person. So I'd like to ask each of you how you got into the work of making sure that we are leading with learning and not with the technology, and why that matters to you. Aaron, could you kick us off?
Of course. Thanks for the introduction. Again, my name is Aaron. I had the privilege of growing up in the amazing city of Chicago, Illinois. And the beautiful thing about Chicago is that you get to see like the furthest extent of success. Tons of amazing people either start their careers or build their careers there. But on the flip side of that, you also end up seeing the furthest extent of struggle. People were impoverished or going through a lot. And that bothered me a lot as a kid. And I just grew up very passionate about that, very ambitious. And I just knew I wanted to make a difference. When I was in seventh grade, they had you take this thing called the plan test. And I was supposed to tell you what career you were set to go into. And sure enough, the first thing that was on my test as I took it was engineer. And nobody in my family was an engineer. I had no idea what an engineer was. So I ended up going to the library. So that's what you had to do back then. And I looked up engineering. And in the encyclopedia said engineering meant to advance the standard of living for people. And I was like, all right, I'm going to be an engineer then. I just thought that... So I set my sights on becoming an engineer, and I was just sure I was going to change the world, build something amazing. But all throughout school, I felt frustrated and challenged because there was like really no opportunities to explore things outside of the core content area. And math was cool, physics was cool, but I was like, but how do we use this? How do we make things happen? How do we change things? So after graduating from undergrad, I still was unsure about what I was going to do. So I was like, well, I guess I got to go to graduate school. That's where I figure it out. But still, I kind of just kept going deeper and deeper into, you know, the typical academic track, and worked in Silicon Valley at a consumer electronics company. And I just felt like there has to be more than this. And sure enough, one of my best friends worked at a high school in East Palo Alto. He said, hey, we just got this huge grant from Google. They're trying to foster more interest in under-resourced communities in engineering, and they're looking for someone to start a makerspace there. And at first I was a bit apprehensive, but after talking to the principal and hearing her vision for it, I was like, this was exactly what I felt like I wanted, the ability to explore things and, you know, get that sense of agency and learn things, how to build things. And so, yeah, I took the job and I haven't looked back ever since.
Well, on behalf of all the students that you, whose lives you touched, and the new students you touch it, through your makerspace leadership at Stanford, I'm very glad that you came the route of education. Sandra, can you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Sure. Well, I started in education on the East Coast. I was working in Prince George's County, Maryland. I actually was on vacation out there and decided to stay, and ended up getting an intern teaching job. And the first thing that was available was a kindergarten position. And I said, sure, I have no idea what that entails, but I'll take it. And so I loved it. I had a great team. I just loved the joy and laughter that kindergarten brought. But it was also extremely challenging because five-year-olds definitely let you know if you're teaching is not fun or interesting, right? So they'll find something else to do. So it really challenged me. I'm an athlete, like, growing up. So for me, like, a good challenge is always I approach it like a coach or a sport. So I was like, okay, this is my team, and how do I meet the goal, right? So that's always kind of been my focus. I moved back home. I'm from the Bay Area, and started working as a kindergarten teacher and slowly moved my way up as a literacy coach, and then as a district coach for technology. And it was funny, somebody asked me the other day, they're like, how did you go from kindergarten to tech? And I was like, well, I didn't. I went from teaching five-year-olds to teaching adults, right? So, and they're not, you know, too different, really. If you're a pedagogue, same thing. If adults aren't engaged or wanting to learn from you, they will find something else to do in that time. So I feel like whether you're a five-year-old learning experience, or if it's adults, you want to make it engaging and you want to build a culture of joy and laughter and really enjoy being curious and embrace failure. So that's really where at the heart of it that matters for me, is making that learning experience and experience fun and engaging for all learners.
I love your story because it highlights the learning aspect of everything, because of how you reframe, well, I was teaching five-year-olds, now I'm teaching adults. I mean, you can't talk about teaching without thinking about learning. It's like the technology comes after that piece. Duane, you've held one of the jobs that I think would be most challenging, therefore least appealing to me, managing technology at the district level. But you've also done some things that seem really appealing to me, like working with people that are highly innovative. I'm really curious to see what you share with us about your journey.
Yeah, so I will tell you that I grew up in a rural town of King Street, South Carolina, which, you know, was and probably still is the most impoverished area in the state of South Carolina. So in my community and in my family, you're either a preacher, teacher, doctor, or lawyer. So, you know, I knew preaching was not for me, even though I was a lay speaker in the United Methodist Church at the age of 11. All of my aunts and uncles were ministers. My mother, however, was an educator. She was a teacher. And so, you know, when I went to college, my goal was to be a lawyer. So I graduated from my college, you know, in June. And, you know, I was going to go to law school in January. But during that time in my mother's house, you were just not going to sit around and do nothing. So she was like, you need to do something. Go teach. So I went to the local school district, the same district that I went to and schools that I went to, and signed up to be a long-term substitute. Went into the classroom, taught social studies, eighth grade. That was my start. And 15 years later, here I am, still in education. So for me, you know, the passion and joy of learning, the ability to understand that, you know, my brain and my imagination can take me way beyond my circumstance. And then learning that, you know, knowledge is power. And regardless of my zip code, regardless of my race, regardless of my area code, I can be anything. So, you know, this tall, lanky brown boy that's sitting here on a Stanford University webinar, like, that's a big deal for me. But hopefully it's an encouragement to others to let them know that regardless of your circumstance, if you just, you know, continue to do right and continue to strive hard, you can achieve and become anything. It may be a little harder for you because of your race, but you have to learn how to, you know, follow folks that are, you know, encouraging to you, and have a strong backing like I did from family. So that's where I ended up in education and never looked back.
That's a great story. I think we all owe your mother a great thank you that you're in this place today.
Yes.
So be sure and tell her when you check in.
I saw her this morning.
Terrific. Christine.
Yeah, so what I appreciate that you've all named is that you're all coming to this work as educators and learners first, right? With a passion and joy for learning, as Dwayne said, which is where we want to start this conversation, right? Sort of centering the learning, the person, the humanity, when we think about teaching and learning and how technology can serve those things. So both Sandra and Dwayne, you've been able to witness this past year sort of from a bird's eye view, and seeing more districts. So I'm interested, based on sort of what I shared at the beginning, how do you imagine using technology in service of more equitable teaching and learning, and sort of share, if you can, how that shifted or what you saw this past year that sort of informed that? So Sandra, we can start with you, and then Dwayne, you can add on.
In general, there is need for educational leaders to be liberated from traditional mindsets and practices and structures that our current educational system holds them up to. And we have a system that is obsolete. When I get asked by teachers, in fact, one of my colleagues today, she's just like, I want you to teach, I need to see what you do when you're teaching technology. I'm like, well, technology is not a content area, right? Technology is a tool that helps us promote access content, it helps promote reflection, it helps give us the ability for some social connection in ways that are not possible otherwise, right? So I wouldn't be able to meet Dwayne today without technology, and that would have been a really missed opportunity, right, for us to collaborate and share our ideas. So I think for me with technology is to take a look at our current curriculum or whatever our learning goals and standards are and think about it in a way of how do I make it relevant and engaging for students to expand their thinking, for them to give me an opportunity to learn something or think about a content or experience or a problem in a way that I may have not have thought about it otherwise because they have access to these tools and the software. So it's really embracing and amplifying this level of tinkering and play and curiosity and just wondering what else is out there in the world without even having to leave your home, right? So I think we saw that a little bit more today and it opened during COVID, and it opened eyes to, I think, more people of how we can connect with others.
Yeah, I'll chime in here. So when we say, you know, a vision of more equitable teaching and learning. So let's talk about the pandemic. When the pandemic hit, you know, we are now in a place where, you know, money's coming from everywhere. We're giving every kid a device. That's equal. That's not equity. So we need to think about that. Equity is when we're looking at supporting the most needy students and making sure that all students are at the same level. So I think that needs to be, you know, we need to understand that. So, you know, just giving a kid a device and internet access, to what end? You know, a device is only as good as its user. Have we prepared the students to utilize these tools in a meaningful way? The other piece, if we really want to talk about equity, my question has always been, what are these students doing on these devices? Is the curriculum ready? Is the curriculum culturally competent? You know, is the curriculum equitable? What are we teaching our kids? Are we teaching them that slaves came here happily? Or, you know, are we teaching them about what really happened? So I think, you know, when we talk about, now that every kid, you know, has access to internet or devices, I always, you know, take a pause to be like, what type of internet access? Are they joining from a hotspot on their phone? That's not broadband internet. You know, a lot of kids that, you know, before the pandemic hit, a lot of folks felt like if a kid had a cell phone, you know, that was suffice enough. No, they need a fully functional device and fully functional, reliable broadband internet. And they need curriculum that is culturally competent so that they can understand and learn in a meaningful way, in a powerful way. So that's how I see it. A lot of folks say that, you know, we need to go back to, you know, how do we get back to the normal? I hope we never go back to the normal, because what folks consider was normal was very marginalized for Black and Brown students. Mm-hmm. How do we go forward now that, you know, we have 90%+ of students and families with internet access? Now, what are we going to do with it? That's my question. What type of curriculum and approaches are we going to provide for our students?
Yeah, I agree with what both of you are saying. And I think especially before the pandemic, the language around, you know, we are a one-to-one school, right? Where we're privileging the fact that devices just exist. But what you're both bringing up is this idea that learning doesn't happen just because a device exists, right? What is the teacher facilitating in that classroom? What is the curriculum sort of directing? What are the experiences that the student has? Are they experiences that will create creators or innovators or makers, incentivize critical thinking? Those types of things that we want to see in people. Is that what's happening in the environment? Or just by having devices, are we still stuck with this what was, like Duane, you said, with curriculum and standards in this sort of assessment that we know is not serving all kids?
Christine, I think I'll use the summary that you gave for Duane and Sandra's comments to do what may initially sound like a pivot. I'm going to bring in the idea from last week about teacher healing and how sustaining ourselves through acts of joy came up and was sort of a driver for about the last half of that conversation. The reason I think it relates to what you're talking about is that if our teachers don't center well-being, both their own and students, this idea of students learning and providing equitable access for students, we're missing a piece of the boat. It's more than the academics. And I can see all three of our guests nodding with that idea. One of the places that I have seen great joy on children's faces is in makerspaces. And makerspaces incorporate a lot of use of technology. Erin, do you want to expand on this concept of how makerspaces relate to both student and teacher well-being and what you see as the relationship between well-being and learning?
Yeah, of course. That's a great question and a great point. I think the beauty of makerspaces is that in its nature itself, it starts with different outcomes and intentions that you want. And then ideally, makerspaces are co-constructed by the people who are using them. So you should be, before you even establish a makerspace, be thinking about who's going to be participating in it and how can you incorporate the things that they're interested in and they want, and make sure that they're an active part in that. And a large caveat for makerspaces is that no one should look the same way. And some makerspaces can be 100% focused on just bringing joy to a community or a school. And that could be the whole point of it. Just come in and do informal learning, explore your passions, could be just a music studio or art studio, and yeah, just bringing joy and excitement and making sure people feel welcome and included. And I think that is a beautiful part of makerspaces. And I think that there's tons of things that you can facilitate within that. You can facilitate projects that, you know, are rooted in empathy, projects that focus on well-being or focus on doing good for others. That's like a big thing that we try to do in ours. And I also think that the nature of creating things is just fun. It's empowering. It's having an idea and then physically manifesting that idea. It creates a lot of joy and excitement as well.
Making me want to run to the closest makerspace. I'm going to pull out two of your concepts. You talked about how a makerspace could be very inclusion. People could feel included. And then you also talked about empowerment. Sandra and Duane, what can you add from the, if we think about leading with learning and letting technology serve, put those two ideas together and now play around with inclusion and empowerment for students. What would you add to the conversation?
I know as part of my role as a instructional coach or facilitator of learning and leader, I try to look at how we approach learning goals so that they center student agency. And just as Erin was saying about co-constructing, that what part of our education and our content can be co-constructed alongside students, right? That it supports and their identity, and it strengthens that relationship, and it removes centering the teacher as the holder or the facilitator of actually, or the giver of knowledge, instead of a facilitator of just practical learning experiences, right? And really allow that student to amplify their own voice and be completely engaged and take ownership of their learning.
Yeah, I think it's important that, you know, students, one, you know, be able to see themselves in the curriculum, but also are able to see the relevance of the curriculum. Like, I'm just not going to learn this for any old reason. Like, if I'm able to, you know, utilize or go into a makerspace, which I love, when I was director of EdTech library programs, like, we had makerspaces in our libraries, and we saw a lot of students, you know, come to life inside of those spaces where they're able to create an artifact of something that they've learned. So when I was a teacher, I taught in a single gender my first year, single gender setting, all boys, eighth grade social studies. And it was fun to see these students come to life by utilizing technology. I didn't just put them in a box. I did away with ABC multiple choice tests. I allowed them to, you know, create artifacts. So, for example, when we learned about the Civil War, they were able to create, you know, a rap or a rhyme or a poem or a presentation to share with me, what have you learned from this unit? And I gave them, of course, some parameters. You know, you had to have vocabulary words, 80% content, you know, go for it. And when I, you know, got the results and the kids were turning their stuff in, I was floored. And I still have some of those rap rhymes now. Like, they really went all out with beats and tracks and really understood the content. And it was funny, when they took their state standardized tests, which they all did well on, by the way, the teacher that was, you know, was doing their test for them, that was a proctor, she was saying, your boys are sitting there nodding their head. Like, I was like, what are you doing? And I was like, they're remembering their rap or rhyme that they created, because that's how they were able to make it relevant to them. So we have to allow kids to, you know, to be creators. Let's stop, you know, sitting them in front of devices and sitting getting. And because whenever kids come to us, we always think about, oh, we need to do remediation. Have you even learned what they know yet before you do remediation? That's the problem. Like, how do we understand what these kids know? How do we allow them to be creative? How do we, you know, sometimes have to step out of the box to help them understand these different curriculum points and sets that we want them to learn? But you got to make it relevant to them. You got to give them something tangible to do.
That's right. And so Trisha has a question in the Q&A, which you all have actually answered, where they want to know, how do we help move students from being consumers to being creators? But what you're saying, Duane, is the expertise in teachers is their content, right? And how am I going to deliver that content? And what you're saying is, when you do projects, you give them parameters around the content, but you give them a lot of freedom with how they're going to express their understanding. And I think that's to what Aaron was saying about the makerspace. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, we remember we got hundreds of emails from these technology companies, yes, right? Platform, platform, platform. But they're all centering what their tool does rather than thinking about, how do I want my students to use this to express who they are, what their understanding is. I think that's what you're saying. You know, how do we move from consumers to creators is really, as teachers, letting go of maybe that fear we have of, we've never used this platform, I'm not sure how it would work in a classroom, and sort of letting students explore that. Does that resonate with what you all have experienced or what you're thinking?
Yeah, I think if you provide the content, let the kids create the end product. That's how it should be. And you know, of course, this is not something that can happen overnight. You know, there's a lot of professional development and training that goes into this. A lot of support from your school librarian, who's going to help teach your kids how to, you know, digital citizenship, digital etiquettes, and also help them understand, you know, how to curate information, what's a primary fact and all that kind of primary source, all that kind of stuff. Like, it doesn't happen overnight. But, you know, if we really want kids to really, you know, gauge, understand, and be engaged in the curriculum and instruction, you got to move yourself out of the way. You got to allow them the opportunity to utilize the productivity tools that your district has, or the productivity tools, you know, even if it's, you know, Google or Microsoft, whatever you have, or Apple, let them create things. Let them utilize these tools in a meaningful way. Don't restrict them. You'll be surprised what you have, what you come up with. Like, you see a lot of different applications that kids, you know, they might want to use Flipgrid. So what? Let them use Flipgrid. Also, what I'll say is, don't restrict them physically. What I did in my classroom when I was teaching, if a student wanted to stand up in the corner all day and not sit down in the desk, and he learns best standing up, so be it. You can stand on your head all you want, as long as you're not interrupting the other students from learning. If that's the best way that they learn, let them learn. Because most times when we walk in the classroom, what do we say? Sit down, be quiet. Like, you're already shutting some kids down. Like, let them stand. I had standing zones in the back of the class. I didn't want them standing in front of the kids. So there was tape on the floor about, you know, 3 feet from the wall. If you want to stand, you stand behind the tape. Had clipboards on the wall, you can stand up, take notes all you want. I don't care, as long as you're learning. So how do we bring that, you know, let's stop restricting kids with those type of little things, because little things do matter.
One of the things I hear all three of you referencing, just kind of building off what you're saying, Duane, is that if we want this idea that our students can be creators, we can be curators of information, they can become the engineers of the future, as educators, we need to make very thoughtful decisions of which things we control and which things the student controls. And I would argue a lot of how we've approached school, we keep thinking the teacher has to control the vast majority. And what I hear each of you saying is, no, 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 that's not where the control should be.
Yes. For example, there's an app for everything right now. And there are some things that we as teachers or educators have not even thought of. And you'll be surprised what kids can bring to the table. Just, you know, give them the parameters. Say, this is what I, you know, I want you to create something. Here are the parameters. I don't care how you give it back to me. You'll be surprised what you get back.
What really helps navigate and support that is the ability to create that strong community in your classroom and really knowing your students. And I think when you establish a community of respect from the beginning, students know, people know. We know if when somebody supports us, when somebody cares about us, when somebody really takes the time to get to know who we are, we want to naturally give them that respect back. And I've really had minimal times outside of just really logistical procedures of like how to put things away. Once I teach students one time, they do it because I respect them. I listen to them. I hear their voice. So when their voice is heard, and that community, there's that strong network and that strong community, the norms fall into place.
And I think what both of you are saying is also true for adults, right? Especially when we think about teachers. I know, Erin, you've been teaching PhD students in the makerspace. So I'm wondering if what Sandra and Duane are talking about in terms of kids is resonating with how adults learn. So I think a lot of times when we think about these conversations, we think a lot about the kids, but it's also important to model that as a school leader for the adults in the school community so they can experience what it's like to have this joy or creativity. And I can think about how I would take that to my classroom.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think a lot of us are conditioned by the traditional educational system where, like Sandra was saying, like you do have someone who's standing in the front of the classroom as like the arbiter of all things. And I feel like in many cases, the kids have less inhibitions than some of the adults that I've worked with, as far as like, you know, feeling like they have the freedom to do certain things or explore certain things. And so I definitely agree that there's a lot of overlap, and a lot of things oftentimes happen in stages. And I think one of Sandra's points is like, you really do have to get to know your students and take a genuine interest in them and where they stand, and even what their competencies are, and know how to best support them. Because for somebody, it may not just be helpful to have a very open-ended, you know, maker project or school project. They might feel overwhelmed by that. Some people are just, you know, starting to develop an interest in something, and some people have an interest but don't necessarily have the expertise. And I think one roadblock can sometimes be teachers feeling like either they have the capacity to know that's outside of the boundaries, kind of what Duane was saying. And I do think we have to come up with more ideas or ways of helping students who are beyond like the develop interest sort of phase, who know how they want to, you know, express themselves, but they don't necessarily have the aptitude to do that. How do we use other resources or other people who have domain specific expertise in a certain area to come in and help? Because that's how the real world works. Is, you don't know something, you go talk to somebody who does, and then, but in school we're like, oh, I don't know that, so you can't do it, and that kind of, I feel like, stifles a lot of learning and a lot of people's, you know, confidence and feeling like they can go and explore even if they don't necessarily have all the answers.
Yeah, I'll piggyback on what something that Sandra said earlier, and she said about, you know, failure is okay. And do we teach our teachers that? Do we allow our teachers to fail? We're not perfect. No one's perfect. And we want our kids to understand that, you know, school is the place where we want you to fail, because we want to be able to correct you and show you the right way to go about it. But I think we don't teach our teachers that, you know, one, fail forward. And when you fail, you have to quickly correct. That's not something that we teach our teachers. So yes, it does go back to how they are trained and prepared. And you know, and honestly, that gleams off on our students.
That's an important point, Duane. And I would say it's not only not something we put much emphasis on in teacher preparation, but also that failing forward is not a part of the culture of schools. And I'm going to use that to link to one of the Q&As, or actually it's just the Q. We're going to collectively work on the A. Nikita has posed the question, how might innovative educators co-design holistic solutions that center student well-being and personal development when admin are so focused on data? It's hard to sell opportunities for students to grow into their own hero of their story. And the reason I think this links into school culture is that if the culture of your school is about accountability to test scores, then doing something that doesn't look like test prep often gets frowned upon. But if I think about how Duane was pointing out the example from his classroom, where he did remove a bunch of the artificial constraints and put his emphasis on, here's what you're accountable to know, now demonstrate it to me. His students still did well on standardized tests and probably did better because they learned in a way that was more holistic, more meaningful to who they were. And I'm using Duane's example to illustrate the connection back to the question, but there's actual data on this. The way to better scores on standardized tests is not through test prep and not through drill and kill instruction. It's through student engagement, paying attention to the whole student, and making it matter that you're in class. So would any of you like to build on that? Let's help our participant talk back to her administration and just have some freedom to do more creative things.
Yeah, I think when you do look at, like, we take my classroom as an example, another reason I did that is because a lot of the students who were being kicked out of class were Black and brown kids. Mm-hmm. You know, so one, are you looking at the data points? So that's a whole different other conversation we can have. But I think it's very important that one, different content departments talk to each other. You know, students should be able to see and connect the different content and curriculum throughout their span in their instruction. That's a big piece. You also, you know, if you don't have an administration that supports you in being innovative, supports you in, you know, doing some of these things and removing these barriers, is going to be hard. I'm just going to be honest. It's going to be hard. But a lot of administrators, I will say, they're looking for that innovative person and they're looking for that individual that, you know, okay, try it. Let's see how it goes. So I think it's important if you're going to approach your administrator, if you're in one of those situations where, you know, your administrator, you know, is not backing you, be able to show him some positive or data points or some research that kind of shows to the point of, this is how I can engage my student. If I can have my student engage, and also, you know, when you look at a student engagement, the most engaged students come to school. You don't have to worry about attendance issues and kids not coming to school and paying attention. And discipline goes down when students are engaged. So, you know, how do we bring those pieces in? And I promise you, if you say those things, your principal ear will perk up very quickly. So you got to help them understand, you know, you got to help them help you and understand, like, these are some points that we can best, you know, engage our students with. So I think that's going to be important. Plus, like you said, that relationship building, just like teachers need to have relationship with students, you know, you're going to have a relationship with your administrators.
That's a good point. Not considering an administrator the enemy. Administrators are held accountable for many of those numbers. So how can we help make their job easier by what we do in the classroom? Sandra, I know this conversation crosses in and out of what you do every day, as well as the professional learning experiences you've co-designed with us. Do you want to add something about how we help not return to that normal of focusing on the wrong data?
Yeah, yes. Well, I think it was during my interview for this job, I was talking to my superintendent, and the conversation, I think, kind of started to end at the part where we agreed on that autonomy and accountability can coexist. And when they do coexist, that's when you have excellence in education, right? So having the autonomy, the freedom, and the trust in each other that I'm not going to fail because I'm going to intentionally fail students. If I fail, I'm trying to learn and push myself into new ways of practice and engagement and to continue to grow with the times, with the technology, with where we are today, making teaching relevant. And if we're doing that, we're going to make mistakes. And showing students that it's okay, recognize your mistakes, let's talk about that, and give them a process and give yourself a process of to reflect. And I think in our work that Christine and I do in our professional development, some of the feedback that we get most frequently is teachers are grateful for the time that we allow them to reflect on their practice and their instructional moves and how they're going to change their practice and what maybe challenges that they can foresee so they can get help from the group and plan for those.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about what sort of the teaching and learning looks like. And I want to pivot the conversation for a minute to make sure that we talk about infrastructure. Because so often the relationship between learning and technology is highlighted by what the students are doing and how do I support my teachers to create this environment, which is really important. But it also leaves out these important aspects of using technology to serve our learners, such as bandwidth, equitable, to Duane's point, not equal, distribution of machines, student privacy, and teacher professional learning to effectively use these tools. So Duane, I want to start with you. When you think about the infrastructure, what aspects most concerns you, and what questions should educational leaders start to consider if they aren't already?
Yeah, so most important is, you know, your technology is only as good as its infrastructure. So you got a crappy infrastructure, you're going to have crappy devices. So I think it's important. When I joined DCPS, DC Public Schools, my first goal was to figure out, like, how do we get to a one-to-one environment, but also how do we change the pedagogy from sit and get model to, you know, kids becoming creators. So it took us 5 years. This is not something that's going to happen overnight. Even though the pandemic dropped a lot of money, a lot of districts did some stuff overnight, but now we can go back and rethink about what does this look like. So before you even address anything about infrastructure, you need to first understand what are your expected outcomes for instruction. You should not develop or create any new infrastructure without teaching and learning in the room. That's super important, because how do you know what type of device, how do you know what type of productivity tool that you're going to select for students if you don't even know what the curriculum is going to look like? What is the curriculum demanding for these students? Also, if you're developing it for students, why shouldn't student voice be a part of the process? That's something that you know, we miss out a lot. So we have to, one, ensure that we're listening and hearing from our students, we're listening and hearing from our teachers, but most importantly, we're listening and looking at what our curriculum will look like, not just for this year, but for years to come, making sure that we're selecting infrastructure that will support, you know, things that we're dreaming of 3, 4, 5 years from now. Another thing to look at that districts possibly could look at is with infrastructure is the devices. I know a lot of districts get into, you know, I'm going to buy this brand new device this year. And then 3, 4, 5 years down the road, of course, you know, something else has come out and now they're stuck with these devices that they have to then sell or get rid of or refresh. So you must have a sustainability process, you know, built in. You know, are you going to refresh every 3 to 4 or 5 years? Or are you leasing your devices? A lot of districts are moving to that where they're not getting in the business of owning devices ever again, because as technology changes, you know, so does, you know, you gotta, you know, phase in and out these devices. So I think that's an important piece. Also within Digital Promise, we just released a digital equity checklist. Which is, it's a resource that is designed to support district leaders in this very conversation of how do we deliver powerful and equitable learning experience for every student. And we've really focused on the most marginalized students when we developed this checklist. So this checklist, it covers from systems to structures to supports that are required to ensure that all students are technically and equitably equipped to navigate and succeed and thrive in an increasing digital world, which we are in now. So this checklist covers pieces of like device and internet access. We also talk about communication and engagement. We talk about teaching and learning, budget and funding opportunities, policies, support and logistics. And one of the most important, professional development. So, you know, here we are bringing all these devices on. Is your staff prepared? Do they even understand how to utilize these devices? You know, how are you going to push and pull content to students? You know, how do you do that when you have kids that don't even have internet in their home? So if you plan and think around the most marginalized students, everyone else will be okay.
Yes, I agree with all of that. And I feel like I'm going to contradict myself right now with everything I just said and say what worries me the most right now is student data privacy. So the more that we use technology, the more data people can access. And I'm not sure if you, any of you had the opportunity to listen to or read any of Ruha Benjamin's work, but she talks about this as the new Jim Code, where we're perpetuating a persistence of racial inequality and at an amplified rate, right? So I think when I gave all of our students, and the majority of the county students are special ed or court students, the day that I gave our students the technology and devices, hotspots and access, I also cried because I literally cried. I was in tears because what did I just do? Did I just create a massive problem? Did I just give all the bad guys more information? It's a real concern of mine. It's actually what I don't, what I least like about my job is having it on my conscience. But I think it's when we have talks like this about it, is making people aware that we need stronger policies. And it's not even schools or districts that can do this. It's we need the application. We need the people who are creating software to be held accountable for storing and using and collecting data in safe and responsible ways. And so that our students are safe. And for me, I think that's always what I kind of carry in the back of my mind as I push new technologies out there, is as much as I want to liberate students, I also want to ensure that when they walk home from school or when they go to apply for a job or then they go and try to access the information, that they aren't being discriminated against for an algorithm that was created against them. We have no clue of what's happening on the back end of those devices, right? And I think the more that you understand programming and the more that you understand how computing works, you can start to imagine, you might want to forget about it, but you can imagine what, you know, people have full access to my home all the time because I think my network's secure. I mean, I'm sure a hacker can get in there really, really easy. And when we think about school systems, the amount of financial data, medical data, fragile information for employees and for students, cybersecurity right now professionals, we do not have the trained employees in our IT system. Our IT actual human resources and education is really low, minimal on resources, right? We only have the bare minimum of people managing and updating. I think when we're making budget plans and we're rethinking schools, especially at the larger state levels, that we're budgeting for cybersecurity because there's more jobs available right now for cybersecurity than there are people to fill those jobs.
Yeah, 100%. Like I said, if you have a crappy infrastructure, which data privacy is number one, you have to take that into consideration. One thing I will say, and I'm gonna turn it over to you guys, is when I was at DCPS, you know, when I arrived, it was open field. Like a lot of folks were, you know, every district, every school was utilizing this application and that application, and no one knew where the data was going. And when I came in, we immediately started identifying, like, okay, we have to come up with a standardized set of tools, you know, being in a big district, you know, and that's where it kind of tugged at me because I'm like, I want kids to be creative, but I also have to keep them safe. And, you know, every time, you know, I went back to that tug and that pull of, you know, being free, open, autonomy, but hey, I might need to restrict. I always thought about this, and this is my mantra that I've had since I was a teacher: do right by students. So I always had to think back to that. And I had a sign up on my desk, and it still sits on my desk everywhere I go: do right by students. So anything that I do, anything that I think of, I have to ensure that I have their safety at first hand. I have to make sure that I do right by them. And data privacy is a big one. So, you know, when you think about those questions, think about, you know, am I doing right by students? And that will help you, you know, figure out, you know, is this the right thing that we're doing for them? And Sandra, I'm with you 100%. When we pass out those devices, I think I gained so many pounds because I started eating so much food because I was so nervous about what did I just do.
Yes, exactly. I think I wish, you know, kind of approached it as we do the infrastructure for the actual physical space. You know, what do you think about when you build a school? Like the playground, the water, the insurance, how do you make sure that, you know, all of these things are tested? How do you make sure people who don't want to come on campus don't come in campus? If we have that approach for the same space, a virtual space, and planning and thought and actually in those fields, consulting us, it could work. It's just that we're not providing those resources because we don't see what happens behind the scenes as we do when we see what happens to schools physically on a campus, on the playground in front of us, right? So I think it's just being able to visualize what's happening in the virtual space.
I'm going to use Duane's phrase, "Am I doing right by students?" to begin to move us into the conclusion of today's session. I'll first acknowledge my great appreciation. All three of you kept systemic inequities front and center in this conversation. And I feel like if we don't do that, we won't be able to resist the return to what was. It was all of you have acknowledged normal was never good enough. We've left too many kids behind. And technology-related spaces are one of the many places we've left kids behind. So as you were talking, here's some of the many concepts you shared with us: empowerment, autonomy, engagement, inclusion, community built, kids as creators, failing forward, cybersecurity, look at your infrastructure. All that stuff and more came out in our hour. So here's your biggest challenge question of the evening. I want you to find a nugget of advice you would offer everyone listening to you to take forward into the coming school year with regard to educational technology, given the infrastructure that's in place, the additional funds that are coming in. What matters most if a district, a school, a teacher wants to lead with learning and have the technology soon? I'll let the first one of you who's ready answer, and then the rest of you just build off of that.
Wow. I will say, if we turn back, you know, looking back, you know, at why we're here as students, you know, supporting students, I would say districts really need to pay close attention. I call it the three P's: your policies, your procedure, and your political will. You know, what policies and procedures do you have in place that are not equitable, that are still on the books, that we're still promoting? And what political will are you willing to take to stand up and do what's right for our students? I see so many, many places, and I might get in trouble for saying this, but I see so many districts now saying, no students are failing this year. And I'm like, wow, what does that say to students? What does that say to students that have really worked hard and supported these students? Instead of the district thinking and stopping and saying, oh, well, let's look at why aren't students, you know, performing well? You know, I understand virtual is going on, but learning is still going on. I've seen a lot of kids thrive in this environment. I have a son that has thrived, A's and B's, now that he's virtual. So my question is, you know, if we're saying that all kids are not going to fail, what data points are we looking at to see why are kids failing? And then my other question, which will probably be a hard question, what's the demographic of those students who are failing? Promise you, you'll see a lot of Black and Brown students there. So what supports are we putting in place to support them? It's more than just teaching and learning. It's a social-emotional effect. There's a saying that, you know, in order to teach me, you got to know me. Do you know your students? Really, do you know your students? That's something that you have to, you know, as an educator, you're obligated to understand and know these students. Even if you were any other job, if you were in sales, if you were a medical field, you got to know your patient in order to work on them. You got to know your product. You got to know your consumer in order to sell to them. So why not learn your students? So that's all I would say. The three P's.
That's all. That's a pretty big nugget.
Huge nugget.
All right, Sandra or Aaron?
I just love the idea of, you know, practicing what you preach sort of thing. Like we have a lot of questions about how we facilitate these things with our students. How do we get our students to become creators? How do we get our students to be comfortable with failing? How do we, but how often are we asking ourselves, like, are we comfortable with failing? And even some of the questions Duane brought up, like, what bias do we have? What inequitable practices are we doing? And then being authentic, coming to your class and being authentic and vulnerable and sharing that with your students, I think is the best way to teach them versus trying to artificially put these identities on them or these expectations on them, but recognizing it, it's hard for all of us to, you know, be comfortable with failing or to get outside of our comfort zone. And then just recognizing, like, you know, that all, you know, that our kids have those things within them inherently. So you're just helping to encourage that and foster that by working on those things yourself. So that's what I would say.
That's an important nugget, Aaron. Thank you. What are we bringing back to our students? And Sandra?
Yes, I agree. I think we need to start with ourselves and liberate our thinking. I think liberate is the key for me in the next coming year, is liberate my own thinking, liberate and amplify voices of others. You know, take those fears and get rid of them. You know, just be able to reach out and ask for help when you need it. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay to not know how to do something, right? So I think as teachers in practice, or even as administrative leaders, we worry sometimes that we don't, that what people are going to think if we don't have the right thing to say or we don't know what to do. And I think we just need to liberate ourselves from that fear and really just be our authentic selves. And collectively, people will join us and come together for our community. And that, it's that collective thinking, it's that community space, and solve the problems together. You know, you can learn a lot from your students. So I think my nugget is to just liberate your thinking and have fun.
Yes, thank you to all of you. This has been an incredibly powerful conversation, and you all are highlighting the foundation of the three conversations we've hosted, that this, there's an urgency for schools to have a restorative restart in the fall. This is not a drill. We need to imagine how to rebuild a system that for so long has not served so many of our students. This series focused on centering relationships, teacher well-being, and implementing creative, student-centered, and sustaining uses of technology. But that's just the beginning. In the months ahead, we know schools and districts can invest both financially and with time in their staff, in deepening community relationships, and in truly centering students and educators to address and meet all students' needs, to remove the barriers, the constraints that have held students and teachers back. There is a liberation that needs to happen from an outdated system, and we hope that our guests have inspired you all to be the change and to advocate for the change. This series of conversations started with the Restorative Restart Report by PACE, and we encourage you to read that report and explore the resources provided by our guests that is up on the CSET website. Our guests who are doing the work we could only hope more schools and districts take up, and share your knowledge with others. Although this is the end of our live conversations, we hope it's not the end of our discussions. So I want to thank our guests, Sandra Velasquez, Aaron Ragsdale, and Duane McClary. Thank you to the California-based family and student engagement organizations, the associations representing educators and system leaders, research institutes and civil rights and equity groups, as well as PACE that were responsible for the development of the Restorative Restart Report that launched this series. Thank you so much to my co-host, Dr. Janet Carlson, and our planning team, Heidi Chang, Leslie Cook, Jeannie Mung, Suzanne Burrows, and Glenn Kleiman. Thank you so much for listening. In the meantime, be safe, be kind, be well, and please be the change.